This week on the Vanderbilt Internal Medicine Podcast.
Very astutely, the intern noticed that this patient was complaining of platypnea, EMG, that showed evidence of widespread acute and chronic denervation that was affecting a number of myotomes that ended up cinching the diagnosis.
How does an increase in apolipoprotein A cause this increase in atherosclerotic disease?
This podcast is made by and for our internal medicine residents to enhance our educational experience. The content, while edited by residents, is not verified by hosts or speakers, and we are not content experts on these topics. The content provided by the podcast is not intended and should not construe as medical advice and should not be used to diagnose or treat any medical condition. We attempt to avoid use of opinion, but all opinions represented are our own and are not representative of employer. Please keep this in mind as you enjoy our podcast.
Welcome back to the Vanderbilt Internal Medicine Podcast.
Fall is in full swing.
Oh, it's nice and cool outside. I have all my pumpkin sweaters, boots. Alex, can you relate?
I can. I have been learning under the tutelage of Dr. Claudia Tombazzi all about brew making.
Ah.
You actually had a good suggestion for his next brew, it sounds like.
I wanted him to do a pumpkin ale, but he was not so excited about that idea.
That would be on point. Now, you may wonder what comes into the job of a brewing apprentice. It's much easier than it seems. I'm the stirrer, and I help empty the bottles that we use at the end of brewing to, you know, someone has to do the job.
Yeah, very much in touch with your skills.
So we're here today to record with Lee across the street.
Thanks, Lee, for joining us today. Let's get started.
Hey, guys, how are you doing today?
We're good, man. The weather outside, we need to start moving these podcasts outdoors.
Oh, it's beautiful. Happy fall, y'all, is definitely one of my favorite sayings. And you know, coming up, although September is my favorite month of the year, October and November usually have one of my favorite holidays. Fall back. A whole extra hour of sleep, extra time on the pillows. And with the fall season, my wife has brought out all of our autumn collection. So she's very happy about that. Do you all do a lot of fall decorating at your places?
My wife handles most of the decorations.
We do not have very many decorations. But I did buy some pumpkins. I will say the fallback is great unless you are working that evening.
That is true. An extra hour on the night shift. No bueno.
Just thought to look forward and make sure I'm not on nights. Yeah. So we will see.
Well, while all those people are on nights, others of us are sleeping at home cozily with our pillows. And as I was preparing for this podcast, I thought that the pillow may represent the most commonly asked household item that we use in our HPIs. Can you think of anything else that we ask our patients about more?
How many pillows do you sleep with?
Exactly. Yeah. So as part of our breathlessness history, we use that a lot. Maybe next year, Casey, for you and ID, you might ask about well water and all of these other things like that outside for our rural patients. Geriatrics sometimes will ask about stairs for a functional assessment. But really, pillows get a lot. And like back pain, we'll ask if people are sleeping with extra pillows or on their sides.
You were thinking about this in all your free time?
Most of my free time. But as I was preparing for this, I was thinking that I wanted to share a case with you where a patient told us about using extra pillows actually made him more breathless.
I think I know where you're going with this.
I know. Maybe because of some of your past interests, you may be intrigued. So I want to share with you guys a case that Adesola and Patrick, one of our wonderful new interns, brought to share with us here across the street. And so they actually admitted to their team a couple months back, a 68-year-old gentleman who was coming in to just see his PCP for knee pain. However, he was screened for COVID at the front desk, and he told them that he was pretty short of breath. And because of that, they ended up diverting him to the emergency department. And when Patrick went down to evaluate him, the patient told him that he preferred to lay supine because his breathing got worse if he sat up. Interestingly, on some of his past medical history, they noticed that he also had had cirrhosis secondary to hep C, although this had been cured by a Harvoni treatment back in 2016. Given all those findings, very astutely, the intern noticed that this patient was complaining of platypnea.
Lee, I'm going to be honest with you. When I hear the word platypnea, all I can think of is platypus, and I'm pretty sure you're not talking about a zoo animal. What is platypnea?
Great question. Yeah, so we talked about pillows earlier, and when we're taking a breathlessness history, we'll oftentimes ask if patients experience orthopnea, meaning a sensation of breathlessness while lying flat, and to improve it, you would use extra pillows in order to elevate your head. However, platypnea is the sensation or symptom of breathlessness while moving from a supine position up to a seated or standing position. That's the symptom, but a common question people ask is what would be the sign that's associated with that, which is actually orthodeoxia, or decreased arterial oxygenation, with a patient going from supine to an upright position. So when the patient was being presented, we asked the group to come up with a differential diagnosis for platypnea and orthodeoxia. And two different residents mentioned two different disease processes. One person said hepatopulmonary syndrome, and then another said portopulmonary hypertension. Both of these entities are seen in liver disease, and both conditions result from a lack of clearance of vasoactive substances that are produced in the splanchnic territory that lead to pulmonary vascular remodeling. Because they can be kind of confusing, differentiating between portopulmonary hypertension and hepatopulmonary syndrome, I figure we should talk about them a little bit individually. Notably, I do want to point out, though, that portopulmonary hypertension classically does not cause platypnea or orthodeoxia, but rather classic dyspnea symptoms that we see with pulmonary hypertension.
So why don't you tell us first about portopulmonary hypertension?
Absolutely, Alex. It's just like it sounds. You have pulmonary arterial hypertension as well as portal venous hypertension, or elevated blood pressures in the portal system. This is actually a disease process that fits into the WHO group classifications of pulmonary hypertension, specifically in group one.
Lee, before moving on, can you just refresh our memories on the other groups of pulmonary hypertension?
Yeah, absolutely. And so group one, which portopulmonary hypertension belongs to, is pulmonary arterial hypertension that is just classic vascular disease of the pulmonary arteries. So this includes processes like idiopathic PAH and heritable PAH. Group two is pulmonary hypertension related to left heart disease. This is actually the most common form of pulmonary hypertension. It's around two-thirds of all cases. Group three is pulmonary hypertension due to lung disease. Group four is pulmonary hypertension due to CTEPH, or chronic thromboembolic pulmonary hypertension. And then wrapping it up is group five, which is a hodgepodge of diseases due to unknown causes. Things include sarcoidosis, sickle cell, splenectomy. But with portopulmonary hypertension, the underlying issue is that there is endothelial and smooth muscle proliferation in the pulmonary vasculature. The mediators of this process are serotonin and endothelin, both of which have vasoconstrictive effects, and because of liver disease, aren't properly metabolized. And so these are increased in these patients, which leads to the pulmonary disease. This process is seen in 6-8% of liver transplant candidates. And so it's not super rare, but unfortunately it does worsen their prognosis, as a large American cohort study showed that a 5-year survival of patients with portopulmonary hypertension was only 40%. And understanding that pathophysiology is important to understanding the treatment, because the treatment is actually derived from idiopathic PAH. And so the drugs target the nitrous oxide, prostaglandin, and endothelin pathways.
All right, Lee. So we're back to platypnea and orthodeoxia. Let's learn a little bit more about hepatopulmonary syndrome and its underlying pathophys.
So hepatopulmonary syndrome is a combination of intrapulmonary vascular dilation and hypoxemia in patients that have chronic liver disease and portal hypertension. So notice here a difference between portopulmonary hypertension is that there's not any pulmonary hypertension here. It's all about the AVMs. So what those abnormal vascular dilations cause is right to left shunting. And essentially you have blood flow that is bypassing the alveoli and there's not appropriate oxygenation or ventilation that's occurring. Compared to portopulmonary hypertension, you still have an imbalance of those vasoactive substances, but for some reason that we don't understand, the blood vessels in the lungs dilate and cause AVMs as opposed to constricting and causing pulmonary hypertension. Pulmonary vasodilation is seen actually in 40-60% of patients with advanced liver disease, although only about 10-15% of those have associated hypoxemia. The definitive treatment for hepatopulmonary syndrome is liver transplant. So there are no medicines that can actually reverse this physiology.
Lee, I'm still trying to figure out why these people feel better when they're lying flat.
Yes, Casey, the mechanism and physiology of hypoxemia and platypnea is fascinating in these patients. And so what happens is you have AVM formation, or abnormally dilated blood vessels that occur in the base of the lungs. So in order to understand this, I'm going to throw a bone to our pulmonary colleagues who are amazing at physiology, hashtag Dr. Funky, and discuss the West lung zones very briefly. In the upright position, if we're thinking about normal physiology, the apices of the lung, or zone 1, have a lower capillary pressure than alveolar pressure, because air will rise and those alveoli are filled up very well, but there's not as much blood flow that's going up to the top of the lung. However, in zone 3, which is in the bases, there's more blood flow due to gravity dependence at the bottom. And so if you think of a patient who has abnormally dilated blood vessels, while they are laying flat, you'll have blood fairly evenly distributed between all three of the lung zones. But as soon as they rise up and sit up straight, gravity will pull that fluid column down, such that more blood flows through these AVMs, less blood flow sees the alveoli, so your oxygenation is worse, and these patients experience orthodeoxia, or an arterial desaturation.
The pathophysiology behind platypnea and orthodeoxia is fascinating, but what did this team do when they had the clinical suspicion? How did they diagnose it? What do we do to figure out and confirm that someone has hepatopulmonary syndrome?
Yes, so that's a great question, Alex. So Patrick did an awesome job as the team's intern, taking a pulse oximeter to the bedside. And so he laid the patient flat, had the oxygen saturations recorded at 94%, and then sat the patient up and, drum roll, the oxygen saturations decreased to 84%.
Wow.
So he did have both platypnea and orthodeoxia, significantly raising concern for hepatopulmonary syndrome.
And so what did the team do next to try to help confirm this diagnosis?
The next non-invasive test for the workup of hepatopulmonary syndrome would be a transthoracic echocardiogram with bubble study.
Lee, I'm going to interrupt you there. I think I only order that when I'm looking for a PFO in the setting of stroke.
Excellent question. So let's just talk about how a bubble study actually works. And so it's really cool, if you haven't seen it, is the sonographer is at the bedside and they actually agitate saline, oftentimes by squeezing saline between two half-filled syringes. This creates a lot of bubbles in the liquid. And then they quickly find the IV in the upper extremity of the patient and inject the syringe into the patient, such that both saline as well as air bubbles travel into the arm vein, then typically the subclavian, to the SVC, and to the RA. And so the question you're bringing up, Casey, is if you see bubbles in the right atrium, and then very quickly see them transfer over to the left atrium, that raises concern for an intra-atrial connection. Sometimes an atrial septal defect, and then other times a patent foramen ovale, or a PFO. However, in this patient, what we would be looking for is bubbles that are transferring over, not immediately, but typically within 4 to 6 beats, showing that they are bypassing the normal microvasculature in the lungs, but are instead going through pulmonary AVMs and quickly finding their way over to the left side of the heart.
So patients that lie flat and feel better, or platypnea, and who stand and deoxygenate, or orthodeoxia, are patients that we should consider the diagnosis of hepatopulmonary syndrome.
With the next step being TTE with bubble study, with an intracardiac shunt, seeing the bubbles in about 3 beats, and if it's a pulmonary shunt, seeing them in about 4 to 6 beats.
And you're exactly right. And if you had normal pulmonary vasculature, those bubbles would just dissipate in the lungs such that you wouldn't ever see them go to the left side.
Lee, I hear our next case that was presented by Ahmad is a presentation that we don't see all too frequently, but is seen more commonly by our neurology colleagues. Can you tell us a little bit more about the case?
You're exactly right. So Ahmad brought us an excellent case that had a number of teaching points about a very unfortunate disease, ALS, or amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, which is also known as Lou Gehrig's disease. He presented a gentleman who is in his late 60s who came in with a number of falls over the past year. He'd also just noted weakness throughout most of his extremities, but also had a number of positive findings on review of systems. Long story short, there was a massive workup that was sent by the internal medicine team, and they ultimately ended up consulting their neurology colleagues, who found a very interesting physical exam finding, or fasciculations of the tongue, which increased their suspicion for ALS. Ultimately, the patient had an EMG that showed evidence of widespread acute and chronic denervation that was affecting a number of myotomes that ended up cinching the diagnosis for ALS in this patient.
Well, the prognosis makes this a really sad case. I think it's an important learning one. The thing I remember is having both upper and lower motor neuron signs, but I know I could always use a review of some of these neurology topics.
Yes, absolutely. ALS is a progressive degeneration of both upper and lower motor neurons, exactly as you mentioned, Casey. And so they manifest with a number of symptoms seen for both upper and lower motor neuron disease. And as you mentioned, it's a pretty grim prognosis where most patients end up dying from ventilatory failure within 5 years of illness onset. Classically, the disease process will begin with focal weakness, but spreads to involve most muscles, including the diaphragm. And the diagnosis uses not only physical exam findings, but the EMG, as I mentioned, which shows both acute and chronic denervation and reinnervation.
Can you walk us through the findings of upper motor and lower motor neuron disease and just a little bit more of the basics of the neurologic physical exam?
Typically, the upper motor neurons are populated in the motor cortex. And whenever these neurons fail, you will see spasticity or increased tone, as well as increased deep tendon reflexes. In addition, you can often see stiffness and other pathologic reflexes, such as cross adductors, jaw jerks, or Babinski. So these are patients where if they have upper motor neuron disease, you would expect to see a positive Babinski, or an upward fanning of the toes with lateral stroking of the plantar surface of the foot. Lower motor neuron disease occurs due to disease of neurons that originate in the brainstem and the spinal cord and ultimately innervate our muscles. At first, in lower motor neuron disease, you see weakness, but then that can lead to fasciculations with spontaneous muscle twitching and over time, atrophy. This atrophy occurs because these nerves degenerate and lose connectivity with their muscles.
Lee, I know you always teach us to kind of think of a very broad differential anytime we have a patient coming in with a symptom. In this case, weakness has many different causes. How do we differentiate ALS from some of the other more common causes of weakness in our patients?
Casey, I'm so glad you bring that up because that's a really important part of our development and training as physicians. I know oftentimes when we hear about diseases, we'll tend to go to UpToDate or another resource, and then we'll read about the epidemiology, the time course, the symptoms, diagnosis of a single disease. But what I've really been trying to push our interns and other learners to do is instead to promote vertical learning, such that they would actually look at the mechanism of a disease that has a common presentation and compare those presentations between similar diseases. So why don't we do that for ALS so that we can learn of some things that have both similar but slightly different presentations. So other things to consider on the differential diagnosis would be, for example, B12 deficiency. Patients with B12 deficiency can present with gait problems. However, those patients have symmetric paresthesias or numbness. So these are sensory issues, not actually motor issues that lead to these patients having falls or gait instability. Another item on the differential diagnosis would be inflammatory myopathies. So these include diseases such as polymyositis, dermatomyositis, and inclusion body myopathy. These patients do have weakness of the voluntary muscles and can also manifest with some bulbar symptoms, such as dysphagia, like we would also see in ALS. However, here the labs can tell the difference, because these patients have actual muscle inflammation and therefore have elevated CKs. Another disease that has bulbar symptoms includes myasthenia gravis. So myasthenia gravis patients may present with dysphagia and dysarthria, but here MG patients often have ocular findings, such as ptosis, ophthalmoplegia, or weakness in extraocular muscles, which would favor a diagnosis of myasthenia gravis as opposed to ALS. And then finally, I want to mention benign fasciculations, because fasciculations can be a scary finding if you're considering ALS. However, there are a number of patients who just have benign fasciculations that don't have weakness or atrophy, and those EMGs would be normal, not showing any problems with the motor unit, and doesn't increase risk for upper motor neuron disease.
When we think about treatment for ALS, I remember in medical school learning about riluzole. Are there any other treatments that we're working on or that are on the horizon to help improve this dismal prognosis?
Yes, Alex. So fortunately, there was a little bit of excitement in the arena of treatment for ALS that emerged this summer. There were two different groups that published in the New England Journal of Medicine potential therapeutic benefits of a targeted therapy. And so in order to understand this, I just want to break down a little bit some of the understanding of the inheritance patterns of ALS. Around 15% of patients with ALS have a positive family history. And so this made scientists interested in a genetic basis for some cases of the disease. Interestingly, in the early 1990s, they found that variants in the gene SOD1 or superoxide dismutase 1 accounts for 13 to 20% of cases of familial ALS. A mutation in this gene leads to what is theorized to be a toxic gain of function. And so what scientists were hoping for is that they could maybe suppress this gene and increase survival. And there were actually transgenic mouse models in the 90s that found this, but unfortunately, it was difficult to translate these findings into human subjects. So earlier this summer, as I mentioned, there were two separate groups that targeted SOD1 expression in patients with ALS and an SOD1 mutation. And this was exciting because they demonstrated a precision medicine approach in identifying gene targets in susceptible populations and designing drugs to go after those targets. So there's hope for patients and families of these patients that there may be new therapeutic options on the horizon. All right, guys. So for the final case of the day, I've got a new one that I don't think you've heard yet. So I want to get your thoughts. This is pretty exciting because not only is it a very interesting case, but this was also presented by a fellow MedPeets colleague, Catherine Mannon, who's one of our wonderful PGY4s. And so she brought in an interesting case of a young gentleman in his early 30s who presented with heart failure symptoms and was ultimately diagnosed with significant heart failure with reduced ejection fraction.
That's raising some red flags for me.
Yeah, absolutely. A 35-year-old with HFrEF.
Makes me think there's something going on other than an ischemic cause.
Yeah, absolutely. Ischemia would be kind of rare in an early 30-year-old. So you started thinking about some of these non-ischemic cardiomyopathies, like, you know, does he have a significant drinking history or a familial disorder?
Yes, I love that you guys picked up on that because that's exactly what the heart failure team was thinking as well. Whereas ischemic cardiomyopathy may be seen later on in life, in a young guy like this, they were also considering other causes. And so other categories to consider do include toxic, such as etiologies like alcohol, cocaine, amphetamines, and even prior chemo use, such as anthracyclines. Infections should also be on your differential. And so you may have had a prior episode of myocarditis for patients that had traveled to South America, maybe had a run-in with trypanosomes, with Chagas disease. HIV is another consideration too. And then there's another bucket that's just kind of other diseases. And so you can have idiopathic disease, giant cell myocarditis, acromegaly, Takotsubo's, and then peripartum cardiomyopathy as well.
Yeah, so at this point, we're left with a pretty wide differential. What did we end up finding out about this patient?
So I'm going to do another drum roll because this patient's findings of non-ischemic cardiomyopathy were not present. He, in fact, had ischemic cardiomyopathy from a very interesting cause.
So, you're telling me that this gentleman in his 30s has ischemic cardiomyopathy.
That's exactly right. While they sent a lot of toxic as well as infectious workup, what they ended up finding is that this patient had an elevated lipoprotein A level of 177 milligrams per deciliter. And in case you didn't remember, like I didn't, the reference range is less than 29.
So over 170, less than 20. You know, when you first said ischemic, I thought maybe he'd have like a familial hyperlipidemia. I don't know much about lipoprotein A.
Yeah, we'll just quickly cover lipoprotein 101. And so we have to remember back to our basic physiology that lipids, such as cholesterol and triglycerides, are insoluble in plasma. They can't travel around in water because they are hydrophobic. And therefore, we need molecules to help transport them through our bloodstream. Therefore, we have biochemical structures that assist with the transport. And these are structures we know and test about all the time. LDL, HDL. Other ones we don't test for as frequently include VLDL, and then also our chylomicrons. So the apolipoproteins actually make up the external shell of these vehicles. And they're a family of proteins that include things like apolipoprotein A, ApoB, ApoE. And there's a lot of research interest into using some of these values as markers and predictors for a variety of diseases. So in this patient, he ended up having elevated apolipoprotein A, which specifically increases his risk of early atherosclerotic disease.
How does an increase in apolipoprotein A cause this increase in atherosclerotic disease?
Yeah, it's really fascinating how this occurs. One of the ways that apolipoprotein A elevation promotes atherosclerosis and thrombosis is by interfering with fibrinolysis. This is through a mechanism of mimicry. Because ApoA's structure is similar to plasminogen and actually competes with plasminogen binding to molecules in cells. Therefore, this impairs plasminogen activation, plasmin generation, and therefore fibrinolysis, such that the body cannot break down clots as well as it could beforehand. In addition, elevated levels of lipoprotein A causes endothelial dysfunction and inflammation. What happens mechanistically is it binds to macrophages and promotes foam cell formations and deposition of cholesterol and atherosclerotic plaques.
So if a patient's found to have an elevated apolipoprotein A, what do we do about it?
You probably would think that we need to try and lower the levels of this using drugs that we already have easy access to, which is exactly correct. And so statin therapy is a mainstay here. And this patient was discharged out from the hospital on a high-intensity statin. Interestingly as well, there's a MedPeds connection here, which of course you guys know I can't resist talking about for a second. And so because of the genetic basis of this disease, this family was also set up with genetic counseling and likely testing of his children upon discharge because they also carried a significant risk for this. So it's important that we try and intervene early with screening and evaluation so that we could prevent them from developing early onset atherosclerotic disease.
I love all the reminders to keep our differentials broad and to continue to think outside the box. I think every case we brought today has that same theme.
Yeah, that's a big theme that we do here across the street. What can I say?
Well, E-Man, thanks again for joining us today. We had a good time talking through the basics of workup of a lot of different complaints and finding some rare causes of those complaints.
Next, you'll have to teach me how to play spike ball.
Oh, I can't wait.
That's our next step.
With the weather as it is now, we can do it anytime. Happy fall, y'all. Enjoy the fall-themed pillows.
Thanks again.
Thanks, Lee.
See ya.